Chapter 4. Prohibition, Compensation, and Risk. Independence and the Dominant Protective Agency. Let us suppose that interspersed among a large group of persons who deal with one protective agency lives some minuscule group who do not. These few independents, perhaps even only one, jointly or individually enforce their own rights against one and all, including clients of the agency. This situation might have arisen if Native Americans had not been forced off their land, and if some had refused to affiliate with the surrounding society of the settlers. Locke held that no one may be forced to enter civil society. Some may abstain and stay in the liberty of the state of nature, even if most choose to enter. How might the protective association and its members deal with this? They might try to isolate themselves from the independents in their midst by forbidding anyone permission to enter their property who hadn't agreed to forego exercising rights of retaliation and punishment. The geographical territory covered by the protective association then might resemble a slice of Swiss cheese, with internal as well as external boundaries. But this would leave acute problems of relations with independents who had devices enabling them to retaliate across the boundaries, or who had helicopters to travel directly to wrongdoers without trespass upon anyone else's land, and so on. The possibility of surrounding an individual presents a difficulty for a libertarian theory that contemplates private ownership of all roads and streets with no public ways of access. A person might trap another by purchasing the land around him, leaving no way to leave without trespass. It won't do to say that an individual shouldn't go to or be in a place without having acquitted from adjacent owners the right to pass through and exit. Even if we leave aside questions about the desirability of a system that allows someone who is neglected to purchase exit rights to be trapped in a single place, though he has done no punishable wrong by a malicious and wealthy enemy, perhaps the president of the corporation that owns all the local regular thoroughfares, there remains the question of exit to where. Whatever provisions he has made, anyone can be surrounded by enemies who cast their nets widely enough. The adequacy of libertarian theory cannot depend upon technological devices being available, such as helicopters able to lift straight up above the height of private airspace in order to transport him away without trespass. We handle this issue by the proviso on transfers and exchanges in Chapter 7. Lacking other avenues of redress, one may trespass on another's land to get what one is due from him, or to give him what he deserves, provided that he refuses to pay or to make himself easily available for punishment. B does not violate A's property rights in his wallet by touching it, or by opening its seal if A refuses to do so, in the course of extracting money A owes him, yet refuses to pay or transfer over. A must pay what he owes. If A refuses to place it in B's possession as a means to maintaining his rights, B may do things he otherwise would not be entitled to do. Thus, the quality of Portia's reasoning is strained in holding that Shylock is entitled to take exactly 1 pound of flesh, but not to shed a drop of Antonio's blood, as is the quality of her mercy as she cooperates in requiring that to save his life, Shylock must convert to Christianity and dispose of his property in a way hateful to him. Instead of, or in addition to attempts at geographically isolating independence, one might punish them for their misenforcements of their rights of retaliation, punishment, and exaction of compensation. An independent would be allowed to proceed to enforce his rights as he sees them, and as he sees the facts of his situation. Afterwards, the members of the protective association would check to see whether he had acted wrongly or overacted. If and only if he had done so, would they punish him or exact compensation from him. But the victim of the independent's wrongful and unjust retaliation may be not only damaged but seriously injured, and perhaps even killed. Must one wait to act until afterwards? Surely there would be some probability of the independent's misenforcing his rights, which is high enough, though less than unity, to justify the protective association in stopping him until it determines whether his rights indeed were violated by its client. Wouldn't this be a legitimate way to defend their clients? Won't people choose to do business only with agencies that offer their clients protection by announcing they will punish anyone who punishes a client without first using some particular sort of procedure to establish his right to do this, independently of whether it turns out that he could have established this right? Is it not within a person's rights to announce that he will not allow himself to be punished without its first being established that he has wronged someone? May he not appoint a protective association as his agent to make and carry out this announcement and to oversee any process used to try to establish his guilt? Is anyone known so to lack the capacity to harm another that others would exclude him from the scope of this announcement? But suppose an independent, in the process of exacting punishment, tells the protective agency to get out of his way on the grounds that the agency's client deserves punishment, that he, the independent, has a right to punish him, that he is not violating anyone's rights, and that it's not his fault if the protective agency doesn't know this. Must the agency then abstain from intervening? On the same grounds, may the independent demand that the person himself refrain from defending himself against the infliction of punishment? And if the protective agency tries to punish an independent who punished a client, independently of whether their client did violate the independent's rights, isn't the independent within his rights to defend himself against the agency? To answer these questions, and hence to decide how a dominant protective agency may act toward independence, we must investigate the moral status within a state of nature of procedural rights and of prohibitions upon risky activities, and also what knowledge is presumed by principles about the exercise of rights, including especially rights to enforce other rights. To these issues, difficult ones for the natural rights tradition, we now turn. Prohibition and compensation. A line, or hyperplane, circumscribes an area in moral space around an individual. Locke holds that this line is determined by an individual's natural rights, which limit the action of others. Non-Lockeans view other considerations as setting the position and contour of the line. In any case, the following question arises. Are others forbidden to perform actions that transgress the boundary or encroach upon the circumscribed area, or are they permitted to perform such actions provided that they compensate the person whose boundary has been crossed? Unraveling this question will occupy us for much of this chapter. Let us say that a system forbids an action to a person if it imposes, is geared to impose, some penalty upon him for doing the act, in addition to exacting compensation from him for the act's victims. This sufficient condition for prohibiting or forbidding an action is not a necessary one. An action may be forbidden without there being any provision for its victims to be fully or at all compensated. Our purposes here do not require a general account of forbidding and prohibiting. Something fully compensates a person for a loss if and only if it makes him no worse off than he otherwise would have been. It compensates person X for person Y's action A if X is no worse off receiving it, Y having done A, than X would have been without receiving it if Y had not done A. In the terminology of economists, something compensates X for Y's act if receiving it leaves X on at least as high an indifference curve as he would have been on without it had Y not so acted. When is a person to be indifferent between the two situations, the time at which compensation is paid, which would encourage boundary crossing since time heals wounds, or the time of the original act? Shamelessly, I ignore general problems about the counterfactual as well off on as high an indifference curve as X would have been if Y's action hadn't occurred. I also ignore particular difficulties. For example, if X's position was deteriorating or improving at the time, is the baseline for compensation where he was heading or where he was then? Are things changed if X's position would have worsened anyway the next day? But one question must be discussed. Does the compensation to X for Y's actions take into account X's best response to these actions or not? If X responded by rearranging his other activities and assets to limit his losses, or if he made prior provision to limit them, should this benefit Y by lessening the compensation he must pay? Alternatively, if X makes no attempt to rearrange his activities to cope with what Y has done, must Y compensate X for the full damage X suffers? Such behavior on X's part may seem irrational, but if Y is required to compensate X for his full actual loss in such cases, then X will not be made worse off by his own non-coping, non-adaptive behavior. If so required, Y might lower the amount of compensation he must pay by paying X to respond adaptively and so to limit losses. We shall tentatively adopt another view of compensation, one which presumes reasonable precautions and adjusting activities by X. These activities would place X, given Y's acts, on a certain indifference curve, I. Y is required to raise X above his actual position by an amount equal to the difference between his position on I and his original position. Y compensates X for how much worse off Y's action would have made a reasonably prudently acting X. This compensation structure uses measurement of utility on an interval scale. Why ever prohibit? A person may choose to do himself, I shall suppose, the things that would impinge across his boundaries when done without his consent by another. Some of these things may be impossible for him to do to himself. Also, he may give another permission to do these things to him, including things impossible for him to do to himself. Voluntary consent opens the border for crossings. Locke, of course, would hold that there are things others may not do to you by your permission, namely those things you have no right to do to yourself. Locke would hold that your giving your permission cannot make it morally permissible for another to kill you because you have no right to commit suicide. My non-paternalistic position holds that someone may choose or permit another to do himself anything unless he has acquired an obligation to some third party not to do or allow it. This should cause no difficulty for the remainder of this chapter. Let those who disagree imagine our discussion to be limited to those actions about which, they admit, the position does hold, and we can proceed along together, having factored out that divisive and, for immediate purposes, irrelevant issue. Two contrasting questions delimit our present concern. 1. Why is any action ever prohibited rather than allowed, provided its victims are compensated? 2. Why not prohibit all crossings of the moral boundary that the party impinged upon did not first consent to? Why ever permit anyone to cross another's boundary without prior consent? Our first question is too broad. For a system allowing acts A, provided compensation is paid, must prohibit at least the joint act of doing A and refusing to pay compensation. To narrow the issue, let us suppose there exist easy means to collect assessed compensation. Compensation is easily collected once it is known who owes it. But those who cross another's protected boundary sometimes escape without revealing their identity. Merely to require, upon detection, apprehension, and determination of guilt, compensation of the victim might be insufficient to deter someone from an action. Why wouldn't he attempt continually to get away with it, to gain without paying compensation? True, if apprehended and judged guilty, he would be required to pay the costs of detecting, apprehending, and trying him. Perhaps these possible additional costs would be sufficiently great to deter him. But they might not be. So one might be led to prohibit doing certain acts without paying compensation, and to impose penalties upon those who refuse to pay compensation, or who fail to identify themselves as the crossers of certain boundaries. Retributive and deterrence theories of punishment. A person's option of crossing a boundary is constituted by a 1 minus P chance of gain G from the act, where P is the probability he is apprehended, combined with the probability P of paying various costs of the act. These costs are, first, the compensation to the victim over and above returning whatever transferable thing may be left from the ill-gotten gains, which we shall label C. In addition, since any non-removable benefit from carrying out the act, for example, pleasure over fond memories, also will be exactly counterbalanced so as to leave none net, we may ignore it in what follows. Other costs are the psychological, social, and emotional costs of being apprehended, placed on trial, and so on, call them D, and the financial costs, call them E, of the processes of apprehension and trial, which he must pay since they were produced by his attempt to avoid paying compensation. Prospects for deterrence look dim if the expected costs of a boundary crossing are less than its expected gain, that is, if P times the quantity C plus D plus E is less than 1 minus P times G. Nevertheless, a person may refrain from a boundary crossing because he has something better to do, an option available to him with even higher expected utility. If apprehension is imperfect, though inexpensive, additional penalties may be needed to deter crimes. Attempts to evade paying compensation then would be made prohibited acts. Such considerations pose difficulties for retributive theories that set, on retributive grounds, an upper limit to the penalty that may be inflicted upon a person. Let us suppose, on such theories, that R, the retribution deserved, equals R times H, where H is a measure of the seriousness of the harm of the act, and R, ranging between 0 and 1 inclusive, indicates the person's degree of responsibility for H. We pass over the delicate issue of whether H represents the harm intended or the harm done, or some function of both of these, or whether this varies with the type of case. We also pass over whether the retribution includes a component representing the wrongness of the act it responds to. Those retributive theories that hold the punishment somehow should match the crime face a dilemma. Either punishment fails to match the wrongness of the crime and so doesn't retribute fully, or it matches the wrongness of the crime and so is unjustified. When others will know that R equals 1, they will believe that R equals H. A person deciding whether to perform some harmful action then faces a probability, 1 minus P, of gain G, and a probability P of paying out, C plus D plus E plus R. Usually, though not always, the gain from a boundary crossing is close to the loss or harm it inflicts on the other party. R will be somewhere in the neighborhood of G. But when P is small, or R is, P times the quantity C plus D plus E plus R may be less than the quantity 1 minus P times G, often leaving no deterrence. Recall that C plus D plus E plus R measures the agent's loss as compared to his initial position, not as compared to his position after gaining from the other party by inflicting damage upon him. We ignore here the question of whether the cost imposed shouldn't be C plus D plus 2E plus R, with the second E deserved for attempting to impose a cost of fruitless search upon the apparatus of detection and apprehension, or rather whether the R in C plus D plus E plus R shouldn't also contain this second E as a component. Retributive theory seems to allow failures of deterrence. Deterrence theorists, though they wouldn't choose to, would be in a position to gloat at retributivists squirming over this if they themselves possessed another theory. But the penalty for a crime should be the minimal one necessary to deter commission of it, provides no guidance until we're told how much commission of it is to be deterred. If all commission is to be deterred so that the crime is eliminated, the penalty will be set unacceptably high. If only one instance of the crime is to be deterred so that there is merely less of the crime than there would be with no penalty at all, the penalty will be unacceptably low and will lead to almost zero deterrence. Where in between is the goal and penalty to be set? Deterrence theorists of the utilitarian sort would suggest something like setting the penalty for P for a crime at the least point where any penalty for the crime greater than P would lead to more additional unhappiness inflicted in punishment than would be saved to the potential victims of the crimes deterred by the additional increment in punishment. This utilitarian suggestion equates the unhappiness the criminal's punishment causes him with the unhappiness a crime causes its victim. It gives these two unhappinesses the same weight in calculating a social optimum. So the utilitarian would refuse to raise the penalty for a crime, even though the greater penalty, well below any retributive upper limit, would deter more crimes, so long as it increases the unhappiness of those penalized more, even slightly, then it diminishes the unhappiness of those it saves from being victimized by the crime, and of those it deters and saves from punishment. Will the utilitarian at least always select, between two amounts of penalty that equally maximize the total happiness, the option that minimizes the unhappiness of the victims? Constructing counterexamples to this bizarre view is left as an exercise for the listener. Utilitarian deterrence theory could avoid this consequence, it seems, only by giving lesser weight to the punished party's unhappiness. One would suppose that considerations of desert, which deterrence theorists had thought avoidable if not incoherent, would play a role here. One would suppose this if one weren't bewildered at how to proceed, even using such considerations in assigning the proper weight to different persons' unhappiness. The retributive theorist, on the other hand, doesn't have to say that a felon's happiness is less important than his victim's, for the retributivist does not view determining the proper punishment as a task of weighing and weighting and allocating happiness at all. We should note the interesting possibility that contemporary governments might make penalties, in addition to compensation, monetary, and use them to finance various government activities. Perhaps some resources left to spend would be yielded by the retributive penalties in addition to compensation, and by the extra penalties needed to deter because of less than certain apprehension. Since the victims of the crimes of those people apprehended are fully compensated, it is not clear that the remaining funds, especially those yielded by application of the retributive theory, must go toward compensating the victims of uncaught criminals. Presumably, a protective association would use such funds to reduce the price of its services. We can connect the retributive framework with some issues about self-defense. According to the retributive theory, the punishment deserved is R times H, where H is the amount of harm done or intended, and R is the person's degree of responsibility for bringing about H. We shall assume that the expected value of the harm to be visited upon a victim equals H, which fails to hold only if the person's intentions fail to fit his objective situation. A rule of proportionality then sets an upper limit on the defensive harm which may be inflicted in self-defense on the doer of H. It makes the upper magnitude of the permissible defensive harm some function, F, of H, which varies directly with H. The greater H is, the greater is F of H, and such that F of H is greater than H. Or at least on any view, F of H is greater than or equal to H. Notice that this rule of proportionality does not mention the degree of responsibility, R. It applies whether or not the doer is responsible for the harm he will cause. In this respect, it differs from a rule of proportionality which makes the upper limit of self-defense a function of R times H. The latter sort of rule yields our judgment that, all other things being equal, one may use more force in self-defense against someone whose R is greater than zero. The structure we present here can yield this as follows. One may, in defending oneself, draw against the punishment the attacker deserves, which is R times H. So the upper limit of what one may use in self-defense against a doer of harm, H, is F of H plus R times H. When an amount A in addition to FH is expended in self-defense, the punishment which later may be inflicted is reduced by that amount, and becomes R times H minus A. When R equals zero, F of H plus R times H reduces to F of H. Finally, there will be some specification of a rule of necessity which requires one not to use more in self-defense than is necessary to repel the attack. If what is necessary is more than F of H plus R times H, there will be a duty to retreat. An interesting discussion of these diverse issues is contained in George P. Fletcher, Proportionality and the Psychotic Aggressor, Israel Law Review, Volume 8, Number 3, July 1973, pages 367 to 390. Despite Fletcher's claim that there is no way to say both, that one may use deadly force in self-defense against a psychotic aggressor, whose R equals zero, and that we are subject to some rule of proportionality, I believe our structure presented in the text yields both these results and satisfies the diverse condition one wants to impose. Dividing the benefits of exchange. Let us return to the first of our two questions. Why not allow any boundary crossing provided full compensation is paid? Full compensation keeps the victim on as high an indifference curve as he would occupy if the other person hadn't crossed. Therefore, a system that allows all boundary impingements, provided that full compensation is paid, is equivalent to a system requiring that all prior agreements about the right to cross a border be reached at that point on the contract curve most favorable to the buyer of the right. If you would be willing to pay as much as N dollars for the right to do something to me, and M dollars is the least I would accept, receiving less than M dollars places me on a lower indifference curve, then there is the possibility of our striking a mutually advantageous bargain if N equals or is greater than M. Within the range between N dollars and M dollars, where should the price be set? One cannot say, lacking any acceptable theory of a just or fair price. Witness the various attempts to construct arbitration models for two-person, non-constant-sum games. Certainly no reason has even been produced to think that all exchanges should take place at that point on the contract curve one of the parties most favors, to make the benefits of the exchange redound solely to that party. Allowing boundary crossing provided only that full compensation is paid solves the problem of distributing the benefits of voluntary exchange in an unfair and arbitrary manner. One may be tempted to delimit partially the area where full compensation is permissible by distinguishing between using something as a resource in a productive process and damaging something as a side effect in a process. Paying only full compensation would be viewed as permissible in the latter case, and market prices as desirable in the former, because of the issue of dividing the benefits of economic exchange. This approach won't do, for dumping grounds for effects are also priceable and marketable resources. Consider further how such a system allocates goods. Anyone can seize a good, thereby coming to own it, provided he compensates its owner. If several people want a good, the first to seize it gets it, until another takes it, paying him full compensation. Why should this sort of middleman receive anything? What amount would compensate the original owner if several persons wanted a particular good? An owner who knew of this demand might well come to value his good by its market price, and so be placed on a lower indifference curve by receiving less. Where markets exist, isn't the market price the least price a seller would accept? Would markets exist here? Complicated combinations of subjunctive conditionals and counterfactuals might perhaps succeed in disentangling an owner's preferences from his knowledge of the desires of others and the prices they are willing to pay. But no one yet has actually provided the requisite combinations. A similar problem arises with economists' usual explanation of exchange. Earlier views had held that there must be equality in something or other between goods that persons are willing mutually to exchange, for otherwise, it was thought, one party would be the loser. In reply, economists point out that mutually advantageous exchange requires only opposed preferences. If one person prefers having the other's good to having his own, and similarly the other person prefers having the first's good to having his own, then an exchange may benefit both. Neither will lose, even though there is nothing in which their goods are equal. One might object that opposed preferences aren't necessary, even apart from questions about whether exchanges might not take place between parties indifferent between two commodities, or might not advantageously take place between two persons with identical preferences, and identical initial mixed holdings of two goods when each person prefers either unmixed holding to a mixed one, and each is indifferent between the two unmixed holdings. For example, in three-way baseball trades, one team may trade away a player for another they prefer having less than the one they trade away, in order to trade this other player to yet another team for a third player they prefer having more than the first. It might be replied that since the first team knows that the second player can be traded for the third, they do prefer having the second, who is easily transformable into the third player via exchange, to having the first player. Thus, the reply continues, the team's first exchange is not for a less preferred object, nor does this exchange move the team to a lower indifference curve. The general principle would be that anyone who knows that one good is transformable into another, via exchange or in any other way, preferentially ranks the first at least as high as the second. Omitting costs of transformation does not affect the point at issue. But this principle, apparently necessary to explain simple three-way exchanges, conflicts with the earlier explanation of exchange in terms of opposed preferences. For this principle has the consequence that a person does not prefer having another's good to having his own. For his own can be transformed into the other via the exchange to be explained, and so he preferentially ranks it at least as high as the other. The various routes out of this difficulty that suggest themselves and that survive cursory examination, remember the two different parties each can offer a commodity to someone for his, all seem to involve complicated and involuted bundles of subjunctives and counterfactuals. A system cannot avoid the charge of unfairness by letting the compensation paid for a border crossing equal that price that would have been arrived at had a prior negotiation for permission taken place. Call this compensation market compensation. It will usually be more than merely full compensation. The best method to discover this price, of course, is to let the negotiations actually take place and see what their upshot is. Any other procedure would be highly inaccurate, as well as incredibly cumbersome. Fear and prohibition. The further considerations that militate against freely allowing all acts provided compensation is paid, in addition to those concerning the fairness of the exchange price, are in many ways the most interesting. If some injuries are not compensable, they would not fall under a policy of being allowed so long as compensation is paid. Rather, they would be allowed, provided compensation was paid, but since the compensation could not be paid by anyone, in effect they would be unallowed. Leaving that difficult issue aside, even some acts that can be compensated for may be prohibited. Among those acts that can be compensated for, some arouse fear. We fear these acts happening to us, even if we know that we shall be compensated fully for them. X, learning that Y slipped in front of someone's house, broke his arm, and collected $2,000 after suing for compensation for injuries, might think, "How fortunate for Y to have that happen. It's worth breaking one's arm in order to get $2,000. That completely covers the injury." But if someone then came up to X and said, "I may break your arm in the next month, and if I do, I will give you $2,000 in compensation, though if I decide not to break it, I won't give you anything," would X dwell upon his good fortune? Wouldn't he instead walk around apprehensive, jumping at noises behind him, nervous in the expectation that pain might descend suddenly upon him? A system that allowed assaults to take place, provided the victims were compensated afterwards, would lead to apprehensive people afraid of assault, sudden attack, and harm. Does this provide a reason to prohibit assaults? Why couldn't someone who commits assault compensate his victim not merely for the assault and its effects, but also for all the fear the victim felt in awaiting some assault or other? But under a general system which permits assault provided compensation is paid, a victim's fear is not caused by the particular person who assaulted him. Why, then, should this assaulter have to compensate him for it? And who will compensate all the other apprehensive persons who didn't happen to get assaulted for their fear? Some things we would fear, even knowing we shall be compensated fully for their happening or being done to us. To avoid such general apprehension and fear, these acts are prohibited and made punishable. Of course, prohibiting an act does not guarantee its non-commission, and so does not ensure that people will feel secure. Where acts of assault, though forbidden, were frequently and unpredictably done, people still would be afraid. Not every kind of border crossing creates such fear. If told that my automobile may be taken during the next month and I will be compensated fully afterwards for the taking and for any inconvenience being without the car causes me, I do not spend the month nervous, apprehensive, and fearful. This provides one dimension of a distinction between private wrongs and wrongs having a public component. Private wrongs are those where only the injured party need be compensated. Persons who know they will be compensated fully do not fear them. Public wrongs are those people are fearful of, even though they know they will be compensated fully if and when the wrongs occur. Even under the strongest compensation proposal, which compensates victims for their fear, some people, the non-victims, will not be compensated for their fear. Therefore, there is a legitimate public interest in eliminating these border crossing acts, especially because their commission raises everyone's fear of its happening to them. Can this result be sidestepped? For example, there would not be this increase in fear if victims were compensated immediately and also bribed to keep silent. Others wouldn't know the act had been done, and so it wouldn't render them more apprehensive by leading them to think that the probability of its happening to them was higher. The difficulty is that the knowledge that one is living under a system permitting this itself produces apprehension. How can anyone estimate the statistical chances of something's happening to him when all reports of it are squelched? Thus, even in this highly artificial case, it is not merely the victim who is injured by its happening in a system that is known to allow it to happen. The widespread fear makes the actual occurrence and countenancing of these acts not merely a private matter between the injurer and the injured party. However, since victims compensated and bribed after the fact will not complain, enforcing the prohibition on these crimes which leave satisfied victims will illustrate the problems about enforcing prohibitions on so-called crimes without victims. Note that not every act that produces lower utility for others generally may be forbidden. It must cross the boundary of others' rights for the question of its prohibition even to arise. Note also that no such considerations of fear apply to a system of allowing any acts that have the prior consent of the person whose boundary is crossed. Anyone who worries that under such a system he foolishly might consent to something can ensure that he won't, via voluntary means, contracts, and so on. Secondly, others cannot reasonably be restricted to counteract a person's fear of himself. A system which allows fear-producing acts provided their victims are compensated, we have said, itself has a cost in the uncompensated for fear of those potential victims who are not actual victims. Would this defect of the system be avoided by someone who announced he would do a certain act at will, and not only would he compensate all of his victims, if any, but he would also compensate everyone who felt fear as a result of his announcement, even though he hadn't actually done the act to them? This would be so expensive as to be beyond the means of almost everyone. But wouldn't it slip through our argument for prohibiting those border crossings whose allowance, with compensation, would produce a general fear for which the populace would not be compensated? Not easily, for two additional reasons. First, persons might have free-floating anxiety about attack, not because they had heard some particular announcement, but because they know the system permits these attacks after announcement, and so worry that they have not heard some. They cannot be compensated for any they have not heard of, and they will not file for compensation for the fear these caused. Yet they may be the victims of someone whose announcement they haven't heard. No particular announcement caused such fear without a specific announcement as its object, so who should compensate for it? Thus our argument is repeated one level up. But it must be admitted that at this level the fears may be so attenuated and insubstantial as to be insufficient to justify prohibiting such announcements. Secondly, in line with our earlier discussion of fair exchange prices, one might require someone who makes such an announcement to make not merely full but market compensation. Full compensation is an amount sufficient, but barely so, to make the person afterwards say he's glad, not sorry, it happened. And market compensation is the amount that prior negotiations to get his consent would have fixed upon. Since fear looks very different in hindsight than it does while being undergone or anticipated, in these cases it will be almost impossible to determine accurately what is the amount of market compensation, except by actually going through the negotiations. Our argument for prohibiting certain actions, such as assaults, assumes that merely to require an attacker to compensate his victim for the effects of the attack, though not for any general anticipatory fear, would not sufficiently deter attacks so as to leave people unfearful. The argument from fear fails if that assumption is mistaken. There would remain the argument about the division of the benefits of exchange. We might wonder whether the punishment deserved, according to retributive theory, for violating the prohibition on doing certain acts, might similarly fail to provide sufficient deterrence of the acts so as to eliminate the fear and apprehension. This is unlikely if the probability of capture is high and the punishment itself is a feared alternative, which punishment would not be illegitimate for feared wrongful acts. Even for persons who benefit much more from an act than its victims are hurt, and so more than the punishment inflicted upon them, this will cause no difficulty. Recall that a retributive theory holds that a person's ill-gotten gains are to be removed or counterbalanced if any remain after he has compensated his victims apart from the process of punishment. The actual phenomenon of fear of certain acts, even by those who know they will receive full compensation if the acts are done to them, shows why we prohibit them. Is our argument too utilitarian? If fear isn't produced by a particular person, how does it justify prohibiting him from doing an action provided he pays compensation? Our argument goes against the natural assumption that only the effects and consequences of an action are relevant to deciding whether it may be prohibited. It focuses also on the effects and consequences of its not being prohibited. Once stated, it is obvious that this must be done, but it would be worthwhile to investigate how far-reaching and significant are the implications of this divergence from the natural assumption. There remains a puzzle about why fear attaches to certain acts. After all, if you know that you will be compensated fully for the actual effects of an act, so that you will be no worse off, in your own view, as a result of its having been done, then what is it that you are afraid of? You are not afraid of a drop to a less preferred position or a lower indifference curve, for, by hypothesis, you know that this won't occur. Fear will be felt when the total anticipated package is positive, as when someone is told that his arm may be broken and that he will be paid $500 more than the amount sufficient to compensate fully. The problem is not one of determining how much will compensate for the fear, but rather why there is any fear at all, given that the total package anticipated is viewed as desirable on the whole. One might suppose that the fear exists because the person is unsure that only a broken arm will be inflicted upon him. He does not know these limits will be observed. But the same problem would arise if it was guaranteed that the person would be compensated for whatever happened, or if an arm-breaking machine was used in the task to eliminate the question of overstepping the limits. What would a person given such guarantees fear? We would like to know what sort of harms people actually are afraid of, even when they are part of a total package that is viewed as desirable on balance. Fear is not a global emotion. It focuses upon parts of packages, independently of on-balance judgments about the whole. Our present argument for the prohibition of compensable border crossings rests on this non-global character of fear, anxiety, apprehension, and the like. An answer specifying the types of harms might come in terms of ordinary notions such as physical pain, or in terms of the notions of some psychological theory such as unconditioned aversive stimuli. But one should not leap to the conclusion that when it is known that compensation will be paid, only physical injury or pain is feared and viewed with apprehension. Despite knowing that they will be compensated if it occurs, people also may fear being humiliated, shamed, disgraced, embarrassed, and so on. Secondly, we should like to know whether such fears are due to alterable features of the social environment, If people had been raised where great numbers of certain acts were randomly and unpredictably performed, would they exhibit great apprehension and fear of the risk of these acts, or would they be able to tolerate the risks as part of the normal background? It would be difficult to detect or measure their apprehension if it expressed itself in heightened general tension. How does one measure how jumpy people generally are? If people growing up in such a more stressful environment could develop a tolerance for certain acts, showing few symptoms of fear and stress, we would not have a very deep explanation of why certain acts are prohibited, rather than allowed provided compensation is paid. For the fear of these acts, which our explanation rests upon, would not itself be a deep phenomenon. Why not always prohibit? The argument from general fear justifies prohibiting those boundary-crossing acts that produce fear, even when it is known they will be compensated for. Other considerations converge to this result. A system permitting boundary-crossing, provided compensation is paid, embodies the use of persons as means. Knowing they are being so used, and that their plans and expectations are liable to being thwarted arbitrarily, is a cost to people. Some injuries may not be compensable, and for those that are compensable, how can an agent know that the actual compensation payment won't be beyond his means? Will one be able to insure against this contingency? Do these considerations, combined with those about not unfairly distributing the benefits of voluntary exchange, suffice to justify prohibiting all other boundary-crossing acts, including those that do not produce fear? Our discussion of the first question we posed near the beginning of this chapter, why not permit all boundary crossings provided compensation is paid, has led us to the second question posed there. Why not prohibit all boundary crossings to which the victim has not consented in advance? The penalization of all impingements not consented to, including accidental ones and those done unintentionally, would incorporate large amounts of risk and insecurity into people's lives. People couldn't be sure that despite the best of intentions, they wouldn't end up being punished for accidental happenings. To many, it also seems unfair. Let us put aside these interesting issues and focus upon those actions the agent knows will or might well impinge across someone's boundary. Shouldn't those who have not gotten their victim's prior consent, usually by purchase, be punished? The complication is that some factor may prevent obtaining this prior consent or make it impossible to do so, some factor other than the victim's refusing to agree. It might be known who the victim will be and exactly what will happen to him, but it might be temporarily impossible to communicate with him. Or it might be known that some person or other will be the victim of an act, but it might be impossible to find out which person. In each of these cases, no agreement gaining the victim's permission to do the act can be negotiated in advance. In some other cases, it might be very costly, though not impossible, to negotiate an agreement. The known victim can be communicated with, but only by first performing a brain operation on him, or finding him in an African jungle, or getting him to cut short his 6-month sojourn in a monastery where he has taken a vow of silence and abstinence from business affairs, and so on. All very costly. Or the unknown victim can be identified in advance only through a very costly survey of the whole population of possible victims. Any border crossing act which permissibly may be done provided compensation is paid afterwards will be one to which prior consent is impossible or very costly to negotiate, which includes ignoring some complications, accidental acts, unintentional acts, acts done by mistake, and so on. But not vice versa. Which ones, then, may be done without the victim's prior consent, provided compensation is paid afterwards? Not those producing fear in the way described earlier. An act risking a possible consequence might not produce fear, even though it would, if known for certain to have that consequence, if the lessened probability dissipates the fear. Can we narrow it down further? Which non-feared activities which do or might cross a border may permissibly be done provided compensation is paid? It would be arbitrary to make a hard distinction between its being impossible and its being very, very costly to identify the victim or communicate with him, not merely because it is difficult to know which a given case is. If the task used the United States GNP, would it be impossible or extremely costly? The rationale for drawing a line at that particular place is unclear. The reason one sometimes would wish to allow boundary crossings with compensation, when prior identification of the victim or communication with him is impossible, is presumably the great benefits of the act. It is worthwhile, ought to be done, and can pay its way. But such reasons sometimes will hold as well where prior identification and communication, though possible, are more costly even than the great benefits of the act. Prohibiting such unconsented-to acts would entail foregoing their benefits, as in the cases where negotiation is impossible. The most efficient policy foregoes the fewest net beneficial acts. It allows anyone to perform an unfeared action without prior agreement, provided the transaction costs of reaching a prior agreement are greater, even by a bit, than the costs of the posterior compensation process. The party acted upon is compensated for his involvement in the process of compensation as well as for the act itself. But efficiency considerations are insufficient to justify unpenalized boundary crossings for marginal benefits, even if the compensation is more than full so that the benefits of exchange do not redound solely to the boundary crosser. Recall the additional considerations against permitting boundary crossings with compensation mentioned earlier. To say that such acts should be allowed if and only if their benefits are great enough is of little help in the absence of some social mechanism to decide this. The three considerations of fear, division of the benefits of exchange, and transaction costs delimit our area. But because we have not yet found a precise principle involving the last and the considerations mentioned earlier, they do not yet triangulate a solution in all its details.